Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin here with us this hour as we continue with Open Forum. Your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which we recommended yesterday for a man who was curious about ghosts. Because I think you've got at least three or four episodes about ghosts over there, don't you?
Yes, indeed. In fact, our very first episode was on ghosts.
But that's what I thought.
At the time I did that, I knew the theory about ghosts, you know, from like a faith perspective and so forth. But I didn't have a background in the ghost literature yet. And now I do. So we've been looking at some very interesting ghost stories, among others, from the history of the literature.
So we sent him to the right place then. Because I know you recently, I don't know how recent it was, but not too long ago, you did one on poltergeists.
Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Noisy ghosts.
Which are believed normally to not actually be ghosts. But yes.
Oh. It's the house settling, as they used to say? No? Something else?
Well, if there's a natural cause, like the house settling, and frequently in poltergeist cases, there are natural causes for things. The question is whether there is and people who report them, you know, tend to get on edge and start interpreting every little thing that happens as, could this be the poltergeist? And so there's usually some natural stuff, like shelves are at an angle or the floor is uneven or things like that, that could be responsible for object motion. And you have to eliminate that first.
I gotcha.
And then you see if there is any residue, anything that's left over that cannot be explained naturally, which would point you towards a paranormal cause. And especially in American parapsychology these days, the standard understanding is that although ghosts can display mind over matter or psychokinesis, that's not what's going on in most poltergeist cases. In most poltergeist cases, there is not a spirit. Instead, the someone at the location is under stress, and that stress doesn't have a natural outlet. And so subconsciously, the person is venting that stress through psychokinesis. And so this is known as the recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK hypothesis. Oh. And a standard solution for people who are experiencing poltergeist activity is to help them engage in stress relieving measures, and when that happens, the poltergeist activity tends to fade.
All right, I would have said you built the housing tract on a burial ground, but I'll go with the stress theory.
Yeah.
888-318-7884, the number. There are actually two lines open right now, so it's a perfect time to call if you got a question for Jimmy Akin. We're going to start in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Joe, listening on 96.7 FM. Joe, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thank you. Jimmy, love everything you do with Catholic Answers, so congratulations on a successful effort.
Thank you.
Just an observation, the riff in the Catholic Answers theme song sounds very much very similar to the song by The Who, ironically entitled Can't Explain. Was that intentional humor?
Oh, no, it was not. I'm looking at Darren because Darren was the main driver of that, but we've never heard that. All right, we'll play them side by side sometime.
It's a good riff. Yeah, it sounds exactly. So it's kind of like telling the world, I got your Catholic answer right here. So my question today is concerning today's Feast of the Presentation. Now, Jesus is brought to the temple for the first time, and this is the time of the Second Temple Judaism, per author Stephen Smith, that was on Kresge in the afternoon. What was in the Holy of Holies? Was it empty?
At this time,
I
don't know that
the Second Temple a temple.
Okay.
Because the First Temple held the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, so the first thing I'd say is I don't know that this is the first occasion on which Jesus was brought to the temple, because the presentation occurred 40 days after he was born, and it's possible that he could have been taken to the temple sooner than that, and it's just not mentioned in Scripture. you don't have to have an Ark of the Covenant in order to have a temple. The Ark of the Covenant is essentially, it's kind of a reliquary in which artifacts that were connected with the formation of the covenant under Moses, like the Ten Commandments on the stone tablets, were housed. And we know, and so consequently, you don't need a reliquary. You don't need an Ark of the Covenant in order to have a temple. Most temples did not have the equivalent of an Ark of the Ark of the Covenant in the ancient world. What's central to a temple and that makes it a temple is that you have worship being offered to a deity at the temple. And in the ancient world, that usually took the form of animal sacrifices, although it could include other things. But the central idea of a temple is it's a building dedicated to the worship of a deity. And so after Solomon's temple, which was the first temple, was destroyed, they had the Babylonian exile. When Cyrus the Persian allowed them to come back from the Babylonian exile, he helped underwrite the building of a new temple, even though by this point the Ark of the Covenant had been lost to history. And so in the Second Temple era, and certainly at the time that Jesus was brought to the temple, there was nothing in the Holy of Holies. And we know that because we have an account of someone going in and seeing it empty. In 63 BC, the Roman general Pompey the Great was conducting a campaign, and by the 30s BC, he conquered Jerusalem. He had gotten involved in a dispute over the rulership of the area, and he ended up conquering Jerusalem and turning it over to the rule of Herod the Great, who was appointed king by the Roman Senate. But when he conquered Jerusalem, Pompey insisted on going into the Holy of Holies, and he may have expected to find the statue of a deity, which is what you would typically find in the Holy of Holies in an ancient temple. The Jews didn't have that, though. They were an iconic, meaning they didn't make statues of God. He may have also expected to find treasure in there, and that's what was being hidden in the Holy of Holies, but he didn't find that. And the sources we have indicate that, you know, he found it was empty. Presumably that was something rather astonishing for him. But even though there was no Ark of the Covenant, the high priest would still go into the Holy of Holies in order to offer worship to God once a year on the Day of Atonement. They just didn't have the Ark to do it with.
You know what? I think I will leave it there because we are right up to the break now, and I want to invite more folks to call because I'm surprised to have lines open when Jimmy is here. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of things, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days, plus one to becoming a better apologist. But now, I don't know if what he's most famous for, but gaining fame and acclaim as the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Have you done a Bigfoot episode? I can't remember.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you did a Bigfoot.
Yeah, Bigfoot was like episode 3 or something.
Oh, okay.
I plan on doing future Bigfoot episodes, but we've already done a basic episode.
Yeah, cuz at the break I tried to give Jimmy the news that there was a study about black bears and Bigfoot, but he already knew that. What drops tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we're going back. We're going to be talking about a reported paranormal phenomenon that we have never talked about on the show before. We're going to be going back to the year 1901 and talking about two women who may have gone even further back in history. They went to Versailles in just outside Paris, which is the home of the French kings before the French Revolution happened in the late 1700s. And while they were there, they seemed to slip back in time to the 1700s. And so this event is known as the Versailles time slip. And it's the most famous such time slip. They've also been reported in other places. But we're going to be talking about the Versailles time slip and what might have explained it.
I didn't even know time slips were a thing.
Yep,
that's an experience people talk about having, slipping back in time.
It's far from the most common, but it is something that gets reported, and this is the most famous one. And they did a lot of research after the time slip. They went through records at Versailles, historical records that confirmed things that they saw that had been at Versailles, but were no longer at Versailles.
Whoa, that's cool. All right, that drops tomorrow. Mysterious FM is where you can go to find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Tons of cool stuff there. Hundreds of episodes now. All right, let's go to Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Colin in Toronto. Thank you for your call. Colin, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. It's my understanding that the church teaches God can be known purely from the light of human reason, but that there are limits to this. For example, the Trinity, which can only be arrived at through God telling us through divine revelation. Has the church ever taught anything about what are those things that can be known about God from human reason beyond just God's existence?
Well, I'd have to do a literature review in order to see, what specifically has been said by the magisterium itself. But it is commonly recognized that we can, for example, reason our way not just to the existence of God, but to the personhood of God, to the immortality of God, to the immaterial nature of God, to the infinite power of God and the infinite knowledge of God. So a lot of the attributes of God, like omniscience, which is all knowledge, and omnipotence, which is all power, those are commonly regarded as things we can reason our way to. In fact, if you look at the first part of St. Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologia, he starts, after a very brief discussion of the nature of theology, he offers proofs for the existence of God, and then he uses philosophy to deduce a bunch of the attributes of God, including things like divine simplicity, the fact that God is not made out of parts. So, I'd have to do a literature review to see exactly what magisterial sources have said about what we can use reason to deduce about God in detail, but it is commonly recognized that we can use it to deduce not only the existence of God, but a lot of the basic divine attributes.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, Colin.
I guess I could have a bit of a follow-up question. Is there like a non-human reason which could arrive to the same conclusions, or is it only because we're made in the image of God that we can come to those conclusions?
So the image of God is typically not understood these days in terms of a specific attribute that humans have, like intellect. Instead, what scholars based on recent research into ancient Near Eastern modes of language, have typically done is come to regard the image of God that we're described as having in Genesis as meaning that we're God's representative on earth. The image of the king, the image of a king would be a representative of a king, and we are the image of the divine king of God, so we represent God to the world. And that's why he immediately upon creating man in his image gives him dominion over the earth. Now, that does presuppose that we have intellect, but it's not the intellect itself that is the divine image. And consequently, it's possible that other creatures that had sufficiently powerful intellects could also reason their way to the existence of God. There aren't, so far as we know, any such creatures here on Earth, but it's possible that there are creatures elsewhere in the universe that have sufficiently powerful intellects to be able to reflect on the created order and reason their way to the Creator from it.
Colin, I appreciate the call and the question and the follow-up. All that makes sense to you?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. That's good.
All right. Thank you very, very much. The number here, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I'm giving out the number right now because rarely do we have lines open when Jimmy is here, and that has persisted today. And now we go to Luke in Seoul, South Korea, watching on YouTube. Luke has become something of a friend of the show. He is, let's see, yep, ready to go. All right, Luke. Thank you for your call. Are you there with us?
Hello.
Hello, Luke.
Okay. So my question is this. Is it possible for God to break his promises or go back on his words? My reason for asking is because in the Old Covenant, especially in the book of Isaiah, Psalms, and in Jeremiah also, he promised that violence will not be heard in the land of Israel again, and there will be no devastation or destruction within their borders. But with the crisis in that region today, it seems otherwise. So I don't know what, Jimmy, what do you think about that? What can you say about that?
Well, so let's split the question in two. First, let's talk about the underlying question of can God go back on promises, and then we'll talk about the specific passage in Isaiah that you're thinking of. The basic answer is God, like humans, because he communicates to us in human language, God can have implied conditions when he makes a promise. Like if let's say someone has really pleased you and you say, oh, it's so awesome you did this thing, I'm going to buy you a present to say thank you. And then suppose after you've made that promise, they decide that they're going to sleep with your wife and steal all the money from your bank account. Well, okay, they just kind of forfeited the present that you were going to give them, because there, even if you weren't consciously thinking of it, there was an unstated condition on the promise you gave them. You didn't promise them, I'm going to give you a present no matter what you do in the future. The reason you were giving them a present was because they had pleased you, and if they do things that then severely displease you, like sleeping with your wife and stealing all your money, then they no longer please you, and they've just forfeited the present. So even in ordinary human conversations, when we make a promise to someone, there are frequently unstated conditions for that promise. And the same thing was true with God and the Israelites. In fact, God points this out in the book of Jeremiah. He says, look, if at any time I say that I'm going to prosper and build a city, and that city turns to evil, I'm going to cancel the promise of building it and making it prosper. And conversely, he says, if at any time I announce a doom on a city because of its wicked ways and they repent, I can cancel the doom because they've repented. And the whole reason God's making this point through Jeremiah, he's explaining that his promises, like ordinary human promises, often carry unstated conditions. They're made in a certain situation, and they're valid as long as that situation exists. But if the situation changes, the promise may no longer be binding. And that's true of human promises, and that's true of divine promises as well. So assuming the situation doesn't change, God always keeps his promises, but his promises can have unstated conditions so that if the situation changes, it may void the promise. Now, when it comes to interpreting prophecy, such as in Isaiah, about there's going to be this big period of peace, there are a few things that we have to ask. One of them is, to what extent does the text involve hyperbole? Hyperbole is exaggeration to make a point, and it's a characteristic of human speech, including ancient Israelite speech, and including the speech that's used in the ancient Israelite prophets. So sometimes they exaggerate in order to make a point. And if you have people who have, say, just lived through conquest by the Babylonians, even a tenuous state of peace in the future could be regarded as a night and day difference. That, oh, things are peaceful now. We're not constantly at war. Even if there is some violence on a low level, it's totally different than experiencing a national devastation by the Babylonians. And so we have to take into account that a given prophetic text may be using hyperbole. Also, we have to ask, what period of history does it pertain to? And it's certainly arguable that various passages in Isaiah are not talking about today, at least not in a literal political sense. They might be talking about today in a spiritual sense, or they might be talking about a future period that has not arrived yet. So there are a number of different ways of reading really promising texts in Isaiah that would not mandate Israel having perfect, constant peace with no crime and no terrorism and no violence, even though the nation is, broadly speaking, at peace with its neighbors today.
Okay, Luke?
Tommy, Jimmy, without telling me your name. That's a great answer. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Thanks very, very much. We're always happy when you call. Let's go to Houston, Texas. We got time. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Benjamin in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Go ahead, Benjamin, with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I recently became Catholic. I was not raised Catholic, so I'm not familiar with Catholic culture. And I find that when I encounter a priest outside of the mass in a social situation, having learned about the immense dignity that they carry, I find it to be a bit intimidating. And I was wondering if Jimmy could talk a little bit about how to interact socially with the clergy, namely the priest, even the bishop or the pope, if you could. Like, what's the etiquette? What are some of the, maybe even the rituals, like bending the knee or kissing the ring?
Okay.
I'd like to hear about that.
So, Benjamin, did you have experience as a Christian before becoming a Catholic, like in a Protestant context or something?
Very limited, yes, but very
okay.
Limited.
Well, I would say that in general, treat priests like you would treat ministers. You know, you would want to treat them respectfully. You don't want to be rude, but you don't really have to go out of your way to do particular signs like kissing their ring or kneeling in front of them. In fact, that would be confusing to a lot of priests because that's not part of the normal etiquette. Now, in terms of bishops, it has been historically a custom to kiss the ring of a bishop as a form of greeting, but most American bishops today aren't really into that. They may tolerate it if you go to kiss their rings, but But most bishops, my understanding is, actually would prefer that you just treat them respectfully. When it comes to popes, you know, a similar protocol would apply. You know, there are special protocols for dealing with the Pope, like one of the customary things if you're – now, this doesn't apply if you're just attending an audience at St. Peter's and you're going to listen to the Pope talk and maybe you get to shake his hand as he's leaving or something. But if you're being officially presented to the Pope, you're expected, for example, to wear black clothing. But they have a papal protocol office that will brief you on anything like that. So if you're going to have a formal encounter with the Pope, don't worry, they'll give you a briefing first.
Benjamin, thanks very much. All the lines full now. What a funny day on the phones. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Catholic Answers Live is 25 years old. That's a quarter century helping people come into deeper communion with the Catholic faith. As we move into our second quarter century, please help us reach thousands more by becoming a Society 315 monthly donor. Right now, when you join Society 315 at a monthly giving level of $25 or more, we've added some extra perks to the other great benefits we already offer members. Go to givecatholic.com and choose the monthly option to start your donation.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the Green-Eyed Monster.
Stuck in envy, getting caught up in the comparison game will help you break free.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
There it is, a little bit of groovy music. Jimmy Akin, our guest, Thursday afternoon, Open Forum, 888-318-7884. I don't know why lines were a little light there for a minute, but now they're all lit up. So lots of folks on the line with questions for Jimmy. Julie's in Indiana listening on 95.7 FM. Julie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. I had a question about, I think there was a ghost in my house, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it.
Okay.
So I was changing my son's diaper. He's laying on the changing table, and he's just a little baby, and he craned his neck backward behind him to look at a doorway and was laughing as if someone was interacting with him. And that would happen multiple times in the same position. And then same room, I left the room when he was in a pack and play. You know, it's like a playpen. And when I came back in, there was a toy in there that hadn't been in there before. And I know it wasn't in there, and he was too young of a baby to get out and get it. So I was wondering if there could have been, like, a ghost in there giving him entertainment or the toy.
Well, it's not impossible. You know, Now, I don't know if you're, I see from our call screener that you're a first-time listener, so I don't know what your religious background is. But from a Catholic perspective, God can allow the spirits of the departed to manifest to the living. That is certainly the case from a Catholic perspective in with regard to the saints. And so if God wanted, he could allow a saint to appear to, you know, bless a child with laughter and entertainment and hand him a toy. And, you know, that's certainly possible. It's also, this isn't church teaching, but it is common, very, very commonly held in Catholic history to understand that God can also allow the souls of people who are being purified, who are on their way to being saints, to also appear, sometimes to ask for prayers or working out something that they need to work on as part of their journey to heaven. So if someone, you know, maybe was a parent who maybe didn't treat their kid that great during life, they might come back and do a little penance by helping a new kid find joy. So those are possible things. It's possible that something else could be going on. You know, there could be other interpretations of what your child's behavior, of appearing to see someone behaving in an entertaining manner, that it could be, you know, you said you were changing his diaper. He might be ticklish, and or he might just be thinking about something. And that could be responsible. There could be a memory error in terms of, was this toy in the playpen with him before I left or not, or a misunderstanding of, you know, what he's actually capable of doing in terms of getting in and out of the playpen and fetching a toy. So there are possible natural explanations here. But based on what you've said, I also can't rule out that there could be a paranormal explanation in terms of a ghost. I'd have to know more about the situation, but it sounds like whatever happened, it sounded transient. I'm gathering this is not still going on. Is that correct, Julie?
Correct.
Yeah, and that's true of a lot of paranormal experiences. They happen spontaneously. They may go on for a brief period of time, but they don't tend to go on long term. And so, you know, once they're over, they're over, and it's not anything to be concerned about. It's certainly a curious set of circumstances, and it's interesting to think that it might have been a ghost, but it sounds like whatever the situation was, it's been resolved at this point. If it or similar phenomena happen and you're concerned about them, you know, feel free to contact me. I am actually a certified paranormal investigator. And just email me at jimmy@catholic.com and I'll you know, take a look at the situation and see what help I can be.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem.
Appreciate that call, Julie. Let's go to Atlanta now. Atlanta, Georgia. Isidoro in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on 1160 AM. Isidoro, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
God bless you guys. Thank you guys for taking my call.
Thank you.
So basically, I was reading the Luminous Mysteries while I was doing my rosary this morning. And so one of the Luminous Mysteries was on the first miracle of Jesus, which was he turned water into wine. Mm-hmm. And then the scripture says right here that Jesus performed this first miracle in Cana in Galilee. There he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So, like, I just want to know, how come his disciples didn't believe in him until the resurrection? Like,
yeah.
Well,
because, like,
so
if I were to see this, like, if I were to see a person doing a miracle such as, you know, changing water into wine, I would be like, whoa, you know, I would believe in him until his death, you know?
Right.
Well, belief is a complex human phenomenon, and it comes in stages. Also, we have to take into account the way that authors will describe it using language. And I wouldn't take this to mean that the disciples, what John says in John chapter 2, I wouldn't take that as indicating the disciples had no belief of any kind in Jesus before this event. You know, they'd obviously had enough belief that they were following him in the first place. They had become his disciples. So they must have had some form of belief in him already. In fact, we even see in the previous chapter in John 1, Andrew telling Peter, "We've found the Messiah." So there was already, you know, significant faith in Jesus. But then when they saw him perform this physical miracle of transformation, that sort of took their faith in him to a new level. And they recognized that that he's able to do more than what they thought. They now, or at least they recognized, they now had a powerful demonstration of his role in God's plan, that he's able to do impressive physical miracles like this. And so that strengthened their faith. So I would view this as a strengthening of their faith. And similarly, other things that happened during the 3 years that they spent with him, like when he commissioned them to go do miracles and they were able to, that also would strengthen their faith in Jesus. However, there was a big countervailing piece of evidence they encountered. They were not expecting him to die. That was not the popular image of the Messiah at the time. They expected the Messiah to be a conquering warrior who would kick out the Romans and restore a Jewish kingdom to Israel and reign gloriously as the son of David. And even though he told them that's not going to happen, they didn't want to hear that, and they didn't really believe that because it clashed so much with their understanding of what the Messiah was supposed to be and do. And they were not expecting the resurrection of the dead until the end of the world, which is when the vast majority of people will rise from the dead. And they believed that, you know, if Jesus died, which he shouldn't, at least not right now, he wouldn't rise again until the end of the world. And so when he told them, "I'm going to be betrayed and killed and rise in 3 days," that was just not on their mental map, and they wondered what he meant by it. They thought maybe he was speaking some kind of parable to them, because he did speak in parables, and so they thought maybe this is one of them. So when they actually saw him die on a cross, it was a shocking event that did not fit in with their pre-existing beliefs. And therefore, when he rose from the dead, we do read that they believed in him again. So their faith was again strengthened in him. But we shouldn't view belief as just an on-off binary thing that that has no variation over the course of time. And we need to read these passages harmoniously with the overall story of Jesus that John is telling us. And so the natural way, I would say, to read John's account of the wedding at Cana is that it was an event where the miracle strengthened their faith in Jesus, but that didn't mean that they didn't have ideas that about the Messiah and what he would do that wouldn't later cause problems for their faith.
Isidoro, it's a break time, so I'm going to take the break, but thank you for the call. If you'd like to hang on the line, I'd love to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you'd like that book, just hang on the line. We will take this break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
If it's central to the faith, You can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest today. Jimmy, of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And you're probably saying to yourself, I can't take it. There's only like 15, 20 more minutes of Jimmy Akin. Don't worry. Jimmy's going to be back for 2 whole hours tomorrow. So just come back tomorrow for more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Going to Southgate, Michigan now. Elizabeth listening on the Alexa. Elizabeth, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering if you could clarify or explain to me what is glory. We talk about the glory of God filling the temple in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. We give glory to God or we glorify him, and I don't quite understand what is meant.
Yeah, so and that's understandable because this is kind of a tricky concept, and there are different terms for glory in the biblical languages, and they're used in ways that are kind of different than what you would expect, given their basic meaning. In the Old Testament, the primary term that gets translated glory is kavod, and kavod, literally, or it's at least its basic meaning, is heaviness. So if something has kavod, it's heavy. And that's gets used as a metaphor for impressiveness. So for example, you know, if you talk about at one point God says to make special garments for Aaron and his sons, you know, Aaron being the high priest and his sons being priests. And he says to make the special garments for them so that they will have honor and glory. So it will metaphorically, it'll make them heavy. It'll make them impressive. And we actually had, it's not used so much anymore, but back in the 1960s and 70s, we had a usage for the word heavy that was kind of like that in colloquial American English.
That's,
you know,
heavy,
we'd say,
man.
That's heavy, man, you know, meaning that's really impressive or profound. And that's basically kind of the way the word, the Hebrew word kavod for glory, would be used in the Old Testament. But then we got the Old Testament translated into Greek in the Septuagint, and the Greek Septuagint influenced the New Testament. And so the New Testament Greek is based in part on choices that the Septuagint translators made. And when they went to translate the word kavod into Greek, they translated it with the Greek term doxa. And this term does not mean heavy in Greek, because they recognize, you know, heavy, what does it mean to say you put special garments on this guy and he's going to be heavy? You know, that doesn't make any sense in Greek. So they chose a Greek word that instead meant opinion or honor. So that's what doxa means. And so by putting in the Septuagint, by putting the special garment on Aaron and his sons, you give them greater opinion or greater honor. And that's the basic meaning of the term that's used for glory in the New Testament. So when we give God glory, we're attributing to him our high opinion. We're attributing to him greater honor, greater fame, greater reputation. And that's one way of conceiving of how glory works in from a New Testament perspective. But there's a complicating element in that the New Testament also, and this seems to be the case as well in the Old Testament, seems to link the concept of glory to the image of light. And And so you have passages talking about, you know, rays of glory, as if it's rays of light. And so there seems to be a light metaphor that's involved here as well, that you know, you can, that it seems like the biblical authors would use the image of light as a symbol of God's glory. So just like God is depicted as dwelling in blinding light, that tells you something about his impressiveness or his honor or reputation. And so you have this depiction of God's glory as if it's a great brilliant light that shines in darkness. And so glory, I would say, is a rich concept that gets used several different ways in Scripture and doesn't easily correspond to a single English language term or metaphor. We do see light being used as one of its metaphors. We see heaviness being used as one of its metaphors. And we see honor and reputation being used in connection with it. But I would say it's essentially a rich concept that kind of bundles up all of those different factors, and you have to look at an individual text to see which, if any of them, best corresponds to the kind of glory under discussion. In one passage, heaviness may be the metaphor that's being used. In another passage, light may be the metaphor that's being used. In another, the idea of reputation may be foremost. Also connected with reputation, there's the qualities that would generate reputation. So, for example, you know, if someone has a great reputation for kindness, that means they have the quality of kindness. If someone has a great reputation for strength, they are strong. They have the quality of strength. And so one way of helpfully thinking about God's glory or God's reputation is, what are the qualities that generate that reputation? What are the good qualities that God has that would cause people to regard him as great in these different ways?
I'm going to leave that right there. I hope that that was helpful to you, Elizabeth, but lots of folks still on the line, and I'd like to get as many on as I can. I'm going down to San Antonio, Texas. James, listening on KJMA in San Antonio. Go ahead, James, with your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, I'm having New Testament John confusion. I need help with. I understand that was a common New Testament name
in the top
time
10
of Christ.
Yep.
And I've read different Bible commentaries that all say contradictory things. So what do you say? There's like four possible Johns I count. There's the son of Zebedee, of course, possibly the beloved apostle, John the evangelist, somebody named John the presbyter, and John, the letters of John 2 and 3 identify themselves with John the presbyter. Book of Revelation just says John, and the John 1 and the Gospel of John, no attribution, but they seem like consistent with each other. And then the last thing is, I've also read that the Greek style, like, you know, when you get into the Greek, you can tell it's different in the Book of Revelation than it is in the Gospel, which might imply a different author. So what gives with John?
Okay, and there are even, now it's true that John or Yohanan was one of the most common Palestinian male Jewish names at the time. It was in the top 10. There are multiple Johns in the New Testament. In fact, one that you didn't even mention is John Mark, the author of the second gospel. He's commonly known as Mark. That's his Latin name, because there were so many Johns running around. And, oh, this one also has a Latin name. Let's call him that most of the time to keep him straight. But his Hebrew name was John. When it comes to the what scholars call the Yohanan literature, which is the Gospel of John, the three letters of John, and the Revelation of John, there are different opinions that are possible, and different scholars advocate different opinions. A very common view through much of church history is that there is a single author who is behind all five of those works, and that that single author is John, son of Zebedee, also known as John the Apostle. However, there are some early Christian sources that say otherwise. For example, at the Council of the Synod of Rome in 382 under Pope Damasus, they identified the second and third epistles of John as written by another individual named John the Presbyter, also called John the Elder. Presbyter and elder just mean the same thing. And that was St. Jerome's opinion as well, because they're identified as being from the elder. And it says that at the beginning of both of them. And that also was Pope Benedict's view, that they were written by John the Elder, or John the Presbyter. When it comes to the Gospel of John, it's directly attributed in the Gospel itself to the beloved disciple. And we have indications that the beloved disciple was someone that was very close to Jesus. You know, he's referred to as the disciple Jesus loved. And many people assume that he therefore had to be one of the 12. And they then do a process of elimination to try to say which one of the 12 could it be. Well, it's not Peter, because he's mentioned by name as someone separate from the beloved disciple. And it couldn't be, if it's someone really close to Jesus, you would expect someone in the core four, you know, Andrew, James, John, and Peter. It's not Peter. It's also not Andrew, because he's named as a different person. And it couldn't be James, son of Zebedee, because he died way too early to be the author of this gospel. And so that leaves you with John, son of Zebedee. And that's behind the conventional reasoning. However, there are reasons to question that. If you want to read a separate case that it's not John, son of Zebedee, but John the Presbyter or John the Elder who wrote it, I would suggest checking out the book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by the British scholar Richard Baucham, B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M. It's an excellent book. Even if you disagree with what he says about John the Presbyter, it's still an outstanding book that is well worth reading. But he happens to think that it's John the Presbyter who wrote this. So did the German scholar Joachim, I have the images of his books in my head, Martin Hengel. Martin Hengel also supported this view. Pope Benedict XVI thought that it might be a combination of the two. Maybe John the Apostle was the original beloved disciple, but then it was John the Elder who wrote the gospel based on the beloved disciple's memoirs. When it comes to Revelation, it is true that, you know, it is identified as being written by a John. And the style is different in Greek than in the Gospel of John. Revelation has a more barbarous style of Greek that is more influenced by Semitic modes of language. So you can tell whoever wrote Revelation, is like thinking in Aramaic and translating it into Greek, but not in the best Greek style, whereas the Gospel of John has better Greek style. Now, to my mind, I don't consider that decisive, because we know Revelation was written when the author was in exile. You know, he's been banished. He's on the island of Patmos. He's presumably confined. He's not going to have access to his usual literary support network. So he may be doing all this himself without the benefit of a trained scribe who has good Greek style, whereas he wasn't in exile when he wrote the gospel. And so he could have, like most people, they didn't write books themselves. They got a scribe, and the scribe would help them do it. So I don't consider the stylistic difference to be decisive. Personally, if I had to guess, I suspect that all of the Ioannine literature may have been written by John the Presbyter or John the Elder. But that's not a church teaching. That's just my suspicion. And I could be argued off that if I had good evidence to the contrary.
James, thank you for that wonderful question. Sorry to the folks we didn't get to. We'll have Jimmy back again tomorrow for some weird questions with Jimmy Akin for 2 hours. Jimmy, thank you very much for today, and looking forward to seeing you tomorrow.
My pleasure. See you then.
That does it for us. We will see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.